Time to take a look at your pet's health on the show today. Larry Mueller here for WPR News, and happy to have back Dr. Bill Stork. He is the owner of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, authored several books, very media conscious, and it's always great to have him come by. We'll start with talking about traveling with your pet, how to plan for it, how to make a good experience for both you and your pet. And Dr. Stork will give you some general health questions as well, or answer your general health questions, I guess I should say. Maybe you have a question about how to manage your pet's allergies, or maybe a new symptom with your pet has you concerned. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Bill Stork, welcome back. Good to have you with us once again.
Well, good morning, Larry.
Holidays are coming up. Are the holidays a good time of year to travel with your pet?
Well, if the family is going, oftentimes they love to be able to take their pets as well. And some dogs and cats are better off being boarded, or sometimes people have the option of having pet sitters and house sitters and things like that. Other times, where the family goes, so goes the pet. So whether it's a good time or not, it's this is when it happens for sure.
Yeah, and a lot of times maybe the person that was caring for your pet or has in the past is also busy at the holidays, and so you suddenly don't have that, you know, that person that you've relied on in the past. How do you minimize stress for your pet during a trip?
Well, by starting early is would be the answer to the question. So, I mean, it is not the least bit too early to start if you plan to travel at Thanksgiving, or especially if you plan to travel at Christmas. And most of us know how our dogs travel, and it varies, because some of them, you know, they're nervous when they first get in the vehicle, but they do fine as soon as you hit the interstate. For others, they get progressively more nervous as you go. And if you haven't traveled with your dog before, then we powerfully recommend that you get started and get accustomed to how it is that they react to being in the vehicle. And if they are anxious about the vehicle at all, then that's a long procedure that takes a while to get them counter-conditioned. And we'll have people work really, really slowly, to the extent that if the dog is nervous at the idea of being in the car, then we try and counter-condition them so that they can be in the car for a short period of time, eat treats, positive experience, working up to the point where they can be in the car to the end of the driveway, around the block, to town and back, until eventually they can hit the road and be comfortable with it. And we'll get the request fairly frequently, do you have something to just take the edge off of them? And, you know, you can substitute traveling to nail trims. And that's a really popular request, but it's not as easy as it looks on TV, because yes, we can give dogs things to help them be less stressed in the vehicle. But when you apply the stress, a lot of times they will override that. And in addition to simply being stressed, pacing, panting, anxious, other dogs can also get nauseous in the vehicle. Other people can get nauseous in the vehicle. And those things we can help with as well. Some people will give them Dramamine. We have an anti-nausea medication that we use here at the clinic that can help with travel nausea as well. But there's a great equalizer that can help people out, whether it be traveling in a vehicle, whether it be traveling on a train, whether it be traveling in an airplane, and that is a crate. And for the most part, when people start off with their younger dogs, with their puppies, they'll use crates as a tool to help with house training. because that becomes home base, safe place, timeouts, and we work out of there with house training. It's also a really great opportunity for either dogs or cats to have that space that they are comfortable in. They know their smells, they know their surroundings. And we really recommend that folks get their pets, dogs or cats, used to that space, used to that kennel, so that if you need it to travel, then they're already comfortable in that space. And there's a really wonderful tool, pheromone products, which to old guys can sound like a little bit like hocus pocus medicine, but it's real. And there's products called Adaptil and Feel-Away that are canine and feline pheromone products that can help pets feel comfortable in a space. And you can use that to transfer that space from, you know, the comfort of your own house, your living room, to the vehicle, to your end destination, which is a really good point, because we all assume that once you get there, there will be space for the cat or with the dog as well. But that's also a consideration.
Yeah, I'm thinking about you're taking your dog or your cat, you're going to have to take some things along, you know, the food bowl. And so what are some essential items that pet owners should pack for their pets?
Well, maybe one of the most essential items is either a printed version, or most of us, most veterinary clinics will have online record keeping systems, or you'll have an app, or you'll have access to your pet's records. Know that you can access your pet's records, vaccine history, medication histories, should something happen along the way. So access to records is a very good tool to never leave home without, so to speak. And then, as you said, if they have blankets, if they have toys that they're familiar with, bowls of food, bowls of water, treats can be very, very handy. And again, start early. Even when the travel consists of coming from South Main Street in Lake Mills to the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, which is about 12 blocks, we'll have cats that will get stressed at that notion. And frequently people will say, yeah, I went down to the basement, and as soon as I pulled the kennel out of the basement, the cat started to stress and hide under the bed. Well, with that in mind, take the carrier out of the basement now and just make it part of the cat's surroundings so that they're really familiar with it and it's not so novel and it's not so scary. And toss treats in that carrier for cats and dogs. Make it a comfortable space.
Yeah, with maybe a blanket or something that they then...
Blankets, sweatshirts, fleeces, flannel shirts, you know, things. Oftentimes, cats and dogs will identify with the smell of their favorite people. And those articles of clothing can come in handy as well.
Yeah, I always, before I'm going to visit the vet for the cats, usually about a month ahead, I take at least 3 weeks ahead, I take the cat carrier out of the basement, or the two carriers out of the basement, and open them up, and it does seem to help.
Positively.
Are there special vaccination or health checks pets should have before they travel? Of course, that would depend if you're going from one country to another, but what about vaccinations?
Now, that's a perfect point. And I will say, with regard to traveling to another country with your pet, first of all, you're usually going to have some pretty good lead time before you make that trip. And with regard to international travel, don't try it on your own. And please don't ask your veterinarian to try and navigate that thing, because I assure you, rules, regulations, requirements, vaccines will change from breakfast to lunch on any given day. And there are services out there. That's all they do, is they help lubricate travel, international travel for pets. Use them because they know what they're doing. You don't even want to try it. With regard to vaccines, there's a few subtle variations with regard to vaccine recommendations. Maybe the biggest one in dogs is the canine influenza vaccine, which out here in good old Lake Mills, Jefferson County, Wisconsin, Fort Atkinson, Jefferson, the population's not quite as dense as it is. If you're taking your dog to Chicago, Milwaukee, other big cities, sometimes even when you go to boarding facilities, they will recommend the canine influenza vaccine. So that's one to get ahead of time. For cats, that would be the feline leukemia vaccine would be the wild card out there. We think of the feline leukemia vaccine for cats that are going to be exposed to cats that are going to be outside. I don't see a lot of situations where cats travel, and then when they get to grandma's house, they're allowed to wander around the neighborhood or the backyard.
For sure. How do you, what do you do if your pet gets sick on a trip?
Well, that's another piece of forward thinking that can serve you very well. And to know as you travel, people, you know, good old Google will identify anything that you need access to. But if you're traveling from Madison, Wisconsin to Denver, Iowa, and North and South Dakota are long stretches. Nebraska is a long stretch. And there's a long space in there when there's not veterinary care available to you. So know your options before you leave home. And here again, a lot of people are traveling during the holidays, in which case, even if you're traveling to Cleveland, when you get there, you may or may not have availability of an emergency hospital when you get there. So it pays to know your options before you leave.
Yeah. You know, some pets seem to travel better than others. I have occasion to travel with a friend's pet, a Staffordshire, Lila, and, you know, she gets into the car and falls asleep right away, and that's the she doesn't have any cares at all about getting into the car or traveling in that fashion. Others seem to, it's my cats, it can be a real trip.
Well, it is. And, you know, there are dogs who won't let the vehicle leave the house without them in the passenger seat. My dog will make my wife and my nephew sit in the back seat of the truck because the passenger seat is hers. There are other dogs that you cannot get them, and cats, you cannot get them into the vehicle without a fight. And those are the ones that we talk about the possibility of some pre-medication or counter-conditioning.
Safety measures? I mean, if you've got the cat or the dog in a crate.
That's a really, really perfect point. And, you know, if you're traveling with a cat, really think twice if you're going to have to get them out of the vehicle. And things that I would recommend, cat or dog: one, identification, microchip if you are going to travel with them, because rest stops and truck stops can be really busy places. So God forbid if they should escape, we want permanent ID like a microchip. You want visible ID on harness, tag, or collar. And another thing that people will do sometimes is they will have a secure harness on the dog or the cat. And on the secure harness, they will have a tether, could be 18 inches, 2 feet long, so that that's on them, even when they're in the vehicle, even when they're in the crate, so that in the event there should be a distraction, if the dog should make a bolt while you're in the process of putting the leash on the dog or the cat to get them out of the vehicle, you've got a handle so you can get a hold of them. And there's another thing. There are dogs out there that are spooky at the idea of being hooked up to their leash. Take that into account and make sure that you have them secure before you open the door.
Yeah. And how long is too long for your pet to travel in a car without a brake?
Well, depends on the driver, because if the driver is an old guy or an old lady that likes to drink coffee, then the bladders will usually be pretty well in sync, and that's no kind of a problem. And I mean, and usually that works out. For example, on trains, they will allow dogs that on trains. Actually, Amtrak is friendly to dogs, so long as your dog is under 20 pounds and in a secure plastic carrier, but not more than 7 hours. And yeah, with regard to how long they can travel, that pretty much falls in sync with, you know, how do they do at home? How long can they go at home? Because if you're gone at work for 6, 8, 10 hours a day and the dog can make it no problem, they'll probably be just as okay driving.
And I would think, and I haven't gone online to look at this, but like airlines, most airlines have stated pet policies in terms of, you know.
Yeah, and most airlines have stated pet policies, and absolutely look at their websites and make sure you're crystal clear. And if in doubt, call an agent, because once again, you might check two or three places and get two or three different answers. But basically, when it comes to airlines, in order to travel in the cabin, they have to be able to fit in a carrier that can fit under the seat. So we're talking cats and small dogs. If it comes to traveling in cargo with dogs, then there's some stipulations with regard to that as well. We really, really, really do not like to sedate animals, for them to be in a crate, for them to be traveling cargo, because it's active down there. When the plane takeoff, landing, turbulence, we want those dogs and cats to have their wits about them, because they may try standing up, and we want them to be able to balance inside the carriers. Brachycephalic dogs and cats, Himalayans, Persians, French bulldogs, those guys with the snorkely short faces are not allowed to travel in cargo. Those dogs and cats are not able to travel in cargo. And also with regard to traveling in cargo, you know, if you've got a greyhound with a really short coat, they may require a veterinarian statement that that dog is capable of tolerating temperatures down to 45 degrees, I think it is. You know, if you've got a husky and you're traveling to Arizona, first of all, think twice about taking your husky to Arizona. But second of all, there's going to be some really warm temperatures on the tarmac during taxiing and things like that. Basically, they're usually going to require health papers, vaccination records, and a certificate of veterinary inspection.
Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today, owner and operator of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. You can join in with your questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Dr. Bill Stork about your pet's health. At 12:30 today, we'll be taking a look at reptiles as pets. But right now, we're looking more at dogs and cats with Dr. Bill. And you can join in. Numbers 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Debbie in Reedsburg with a question. Debbie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I had a question. My mom just come down with COVID yesterday, and she's got it pretty bad. And I was wondering if dogs can get on her medical paper. It said avoid contact with pets. Now, does that mean he can get
COVID as well? Yeah.
Not the same. While in dogs and cats, yes, there are coronaviruses, but they are not the same strains that affect people.
So in that, in this case, not something to necessarily worry about.
Nope.
All right. Nope. There you go, Debbie. Thank you very much for calling. Carol in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Is such a timely topic for me because my four-month-old standard poodle is recovering from Campylobacter infection that our veterinarian felt he contracted because of the freeze-dried raw chicken necks that I had been giving him as treats. So I'd like to know what the doctor's opinion is about those products.
Freeze-dried products.
Well, my opinion with regard to freeze-dried products is they are some of our favorites because they are usually very lowly allergenic, and they're usually very predictable as far as what's in them, because if you feed freeze-dried liver, there is liver in there and nothing else. And they're usually a very high-value treats when we're training dogs. Heck, we have cats that'll dive into the treat jar at the clinic and gobble up the freeze-dried products. So I would not vilify all of freeze-dried products as a result of a bad experience. You know, what I would do is I would go back to the manufacturer and say, you know, around us, we have a great source, a butcher in Watertown, where we get our freeze-dried products, and we've never had anything that resembled a problem. But just as is the case with any business, if a customer has a bad experience, then the owner of that establishment would surely want to know so that they can take correct measures.
Yeah. So get back to the company itself.
Well, yeah. And another thing to keep in mind, it's always, you know, is that a post-production situation? Because worthy of note is that those butchers and those facilities are intensely inspected by health professionals. So nothing is perfect, but it's a pretty good system.
Yeah. Carol, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mike in Galesville, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
We've got an American Eskimo that's about 7 years old. We've had her for 6 years. Three times over those years, she, all of a sudden, she'll get a like a spasm and fall over. And then within a minute or two, she'll come back around and be her normal self. Any suggestions on what might be a problem?
Is this, does this happen just when she's excited, or what, or does she just drop over?
The last time it was when she was very excited. Two other times it was just basically a normal evening in the house, and she just drops over.
Okay.
Well, you just made a really good description of a dog that's having seizure episodes. And especially when you describe that as a very finite event that took place for about a minute. And then very shortly thereafter, she recovered and everything was fine. So with regard to seizure events, the things that we look at are some of the things you've commented on already, which is how frequently does it happen? I would recommend, you know, whether you're acoustic or digital, write it down on a calendar, or there's even apps to track your dog's seizure episodes so that you can log the frequency, the duration, how long it takes them to recover. And then if they return to absolute normal after it has taken place. So those are the things you want to monitor with regard to the episodes of the seizures. Also, how impactful it is. If you have the ability to pull out your phone or your camera and get a video of it, That would be incredibly helpful to your veterinarian because they can extract a lot of information out of a video of the event. And I'd also get him or her checked out. Just we'll usually run some baseline blood work to make sure there's no electrolyte, liver, or kidney issues that could be contributing to this situation. You know, at 3 times in 7 years, we usually don't medicate those dogs. But if they start to become more frequent, longer, more impactful, or it takes them longer to recover, that's when we start to think about treating them for seizure disorders.
And there are medications for that, obviously.
Positively.
All right. Mike, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Pet health question, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Somebody wondered, are there cruise lines that accept pets on trips?
The answer to that question is yes, with an asterisk. And what I could find, and first of all, I've never been on a cruise myself, so this is straight out of research, straight out of Google. And yes, there are pet-friendly cruises, but they are pet-specific cruises. From what I hear about going on a cruise, I mean, it's like a troop movement, getting the people onto and off of the ship at each and every port, let alone having to navigate the specifics of pets as well. Not to mention that when you're at sea, there's a pretty good chance that there's not going to be a veterinarian on that ship, which is a real consideration should your pet get sick. And of course, they will make accommodations for assist and service dogs on a lot of the cruise lines. But in general, if you want to cruise with your dog, it's probably going to be a custom trip on a smaller ship.
Got it. And back on land, you're at a hotel. What are typical pet restrictions at hotels?
You know, there's starting to be more and more hotels that are inviting pets in. And I feel like decorum prevails. I mean, hopefully your pet is fully house trained and able to go outside and also doesn't bark and keep the neighbors up throughout the night, like if you have a room next to the ice machine or something like that. So I don't think that's a lot of difference than if you live in an apartment complex.
Yeah, it's probably. And some hotels, I'm sure, may have some added fees.
They will have added fees, but heck, the Iron Horse Hotel in downtown Milwaukee, next to the elevators, they have water and food, water bowls for the pets that come by. So,
what about pets as house guests? When, you know, you're staying at home of a friend or maybe a family member, what house rules are reasonable and you know, when might you be better off boarding?
Well, hopefully whomever it is that you're going to go visit over the holidays, you know them well enough to know their position on pets and to, well, other things to take into consideration. Are there people there who are allergic to dogs and cats? Are there people who are phobic, who are scared, have had a bad experience with dogs and cats? That's a real live consideration as well. And do they have the facilities? Do they have a fenced-in backyard? Do they live next to a busy highway? And not to get back to a not to beat a dead horse, but man, it's another opportunity for a dog to be familiar and comfortable in a crate. Because if you can put them in the crate, then you know that they are contained and they're not going to, you know, have an accident in somebody's house, being in unfamiliar surroundings or anything to that effect. When my wife and I travel with our dogs, they are there's no place that they're more comfortable than in the cab of my pickup truck. So a lot of times, if it's not 10 below zero or 95 degrees outside, they'll just hunker down in the truck and they could not be happier.
Any recommendations for pet-friendly destinations or maybe travel apps or websites?
You know, there's a whole new product out there that seems so darn obvious. Why did it take so long for it to exist? And maybe it's existed for a good long time, and I'm the one that's late to the party to just hear about these things. But there is an app for dog parks, private dog parks that you can rent time in, like an Airbnb. So like you're going to Colorado and you're going to travel through Nebraska and you want to stop in North Platte, Nebraska, there's probably a private dog park out there that you can rent from noon to two the day before Thanksgiving while you're on your way to Denver. And there's one in such space in Deerfield, Wisconsin, I happen to know about. But just like everything else, there's websites and apps, but it's something similar, a similar arrangement to an Airbnb. It's just you rent it for an hour or two at a time.
Yeah. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today, talking your pet's health. Questions for him, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Megan emailed in. She wants to know, what is the best brand of food to feed her 4.5-month-old Great Dane? And also, what is the best bloat kit to have on hand?
With regard to the bloat kit, a tool that can be handy is simethicone, Gas-X, Beano. Can be a surfactant that can be really, really valuable to them. And with regard to the best food, I guess an answer would be a lot of it, because a 4-month-old Great Dane is going to be putting away a lot of food. And to an extent, that depends on where Megan lives. And there are a lot of really, really good foods out there, ranging from things like Fromm, which is one of my favorite recommendations because it's made right here in Wisconsin. The company is 130 years old. Their plant is cleaner than my kitchen. And there's Blue Buffalo. There's a whole big bunch of really high quality foods. And even, heck, I mean, Purina and Pro Plan are all good foods as well. I love the fact that Megan is thinking about bloat, because assuming she's having her 4.5-month-old Great Dane spayed or neutered, you may ask your veterinarian at the spay or at the neuter about a gastropexy at the time of that surgery, so as to largely prevent a gastric dilation volvulus.
Sarah is wondering if you could talk a bit about feline immunodeficiency virus, or it's called FIV. Her 5-month-old kitten tested positive when he was 2 months old, and she's wondering, what can she do to help make sure he stays as healthy as possible?
FIV, feline immunodeficiency virus. The things that I would recommend, first of all, is to not necessarily panic, because we will have these cats that will test positive. We will usually recommend retesting them in about 6 months, because a fair percentage of them will seroconvert. And sparing you a whole big bunch of immunology with regard to FIV, in my clinical experience, and we've seen a number of FIV positive cats, they're not the cats that end up living to be 22 years old, but they are the cats that it's not unusual for them to be 12 or 13 years old. They're just essentially their immune system is a bit suppressed. I wouldn't necessarily recommend taking them to a boarding facility or a cattery or things where they're going to be extremely exposed. And I would probably recommend this being an indoor cat or a cat that goes outside under supervision.
How does it present?
Well, it presents as the clinical symptoms of the other diseases that they would be exposed to, like mycoplasma and other respiratory pathogens that they would be exposed to, because the FIV downregulates their immune system.
And John from Fort Atkinson emailed. He has a mini Bernedoodle. And one foreleg dew claw appears to have been injured. It's no longer positioned correctly. Very tender, and he's licking it a lot. Can it heal, or will it need to be removed, that foreleg dew claw?
That foreleg dew claw, probably not removed. And my best analogy for this is kind of like when we smash our thumb with a hammer or smash it in the door or something like that. It is uncomfortable. They will lick at it for a while. If there is a fragment, the end, if there's a piece of that dew claw that's hanging off, we will trim it off. From that point, it's just a matter of it healing on its own. And if the dog is uncomfortable, then we'll put it on some anti-inflammatories. If the dog absolutely will not leave it alone, then sometimes we'll use a cone just to break the cycle of them licking at it. In a dog of that age, we usually shy away from removing those dew claws unless some of them will really, really be pendulous. Some of them will be really, really dangly, and we'll recommend removing them. But when we remove dew claws, we much prefer to do that literally at birth, because there are some schools of thought out there that suggest that removing a four-leg dew claw later on in life can, to some extent, destabilize that carpus.
No, that makes good sense. Dr. Bill Stork, our guest today of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, where he serves as owner and operator. Questions for him about your pet's health, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we take a look at your pet's health with our guest, Dr. Bill Stork from the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. Just a quick note, tomorrow on the show we'll talk about preserving and enhancing national historic places, and then we'll preview the first ever Wisconsin Neonic Forum. That's tomorrow at 11. But right now, focusing on your pet's health, join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Let's turn to Nick in Green Bay. Hi, Nick.
Hi, I've got a 100-pound lab. He's a lap dog. But my question for you is, like, on his right leg, right where the elbow is, it's like a really dry spot. And I was wondering what I do to solve that issue. It's the only spot on his body where it's really crusty.
And how old did you say he is?
He's five.
5 years old. So the Scrabble word for that is a decubital ulcer. And what it is a callus. And you will see those take place in areas where there is essentially skin and bone. And when they lay on firm surfaces, then that's the body's response to rearranging that area so it's a little bit tougher. It's the same physiologic process as when we form calluses in our hands. And if it is just thickened and crusty and tough, then we don't really have to do anything. On occasion, they'll get a little irritated and bloody. And, you know, as far as things to do for that, aloe can help, and bag balm and things like that. Whatever your favorite moisturizer is. As far as prevention is concerned, you know, providing them a soft place to lay can help delay the formation of them. But lots of dogs that have them, and in my experience, and I bet yours as well, you could line your house with $100 dog beds and they'll lay on the concrete floor.
Nick, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Tim and Ladysmith will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Tim.
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I've got an 11-year-old Staffordshire Terrier pit bull who's got growths all over his body. He's aging. Most of them are just cysts if he's been to the vet, obviously. But he's developed a neurological problem, and I can't remember what the vet was saying. I think it's something developing in his hips. His muscles seem to be degenerating, his legs. But what's more concerning is from that neurological disease, he's developing what they want to say is laryngeal paralysis. They have him on carprofen and I do believe duloxetine twice a day. I can't remember the milligram dose. And he seems to be doing a little bit better. But I guess the question is there anything else to use to treat this neurological issue? She told me to keep him out of the sun, keep him his temp down, watch if he's respirating more than 30 times a minute, because I'm obviously quite a distance from a veterinarian. So if he starts to become a situation where his larynx does paralyze, I don't know how I'm going to keep him from suffocating. So I didn't know if you had any treatment thoughts on that process.
Hmm. Well, the good news is those are the kind of things that usually don't progress rapidly. And a lot of times we'll call that condition LARPAR because it sounds a little less scary than laryngeal paralysis. And what physiologically is happening in there is the larynx are the cartilages that separate the esophagus from the trachea. And as they age, as is the case with any other cartilages, they have a tendency to relax. So when they're breathing harder and moving large volumes of air past those cartilages, they'll vibrate and he'll get that. I hope that didn't sound horrible on the radio, but it's a really distinct sound. And it usually doesn't progress rapidly. And everything that your veterinarian recommended with regard to simply minimizing stress and heat exposure will go a long way. There is a medication called, doxepin, that is said to be beneficial. Now, if you dive into the literature is pretty torn, and there's no absolute research that suggests that it is effective, but quantitatively, one of our ACE technicians here at the clinic had a dog that had LARPAR and swore that it helped. That drug is not quite as available as it has been in the past to the extent that we have to prescribe it through a human side pharmacy. I don't think it's wildly expensive. Opinions vary as far as the extent to which it may help.
All right. There you go, Tim. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. What are the symptoms of allergies in dogs, and how can you figure out what dogs are allergic to?
Well, the symptoms of allergies in dogs, of course, they vary with the dogs, but the classic is when the dog comes into the clinic and their paws have been stained kind of a copper color, that is saliva stain and powerfully suggestive that the dog may be experiencing allergies. Of course, there are other causes. Fleas and mites and things like that can be culprits as well. And of course, dogs will lick, dogs will scratch, but in order to somewhat objectify that, we will say, does your dog lick to the point that it keeps you up at night or keeps him up at night or interrupts what he or she is doing? They'll rub their face, they'll rub their eyes, they'll scratch their flank. When you put your fingers on them, they'll do the happy dance when you touch them. And when we're treating those allergic dogs, we love to be able to intervene before we move into skin infections and hot spots and things like that. And to get to Larry's question as far as how do you know what they are allergic to, the short answer is we don't. And the very natural, very human reaction is to start changing their food. And if they're on a beef, to change them to chicken, to change them to lamb, whatever the case may be. Things to keep in mind if you start to change food is that, let's say you move away from chicken, that dog cannot have chicken in any form. In addition to the fact that you have to wait at least 8, if not 12 weeks of being on the new and novel food to judge if there is an improvement. And as far as other things that they're allergic to, if it's not food, we get a little bit of an indication of that when we do allergy testing on dogs, because when we do allergy testing, we will literally test them for somewhere around 160 different allergens. And we've learned from when we allergy test those dogs, they're usually allergic to about 70 of those 160 things, but allergies have a tendency to be additive in dogs. So the answer is oftentimes airborne things can be a culprit, because when people start to develop itchy eyes, runny nose, tight sinuses, that's also the time of the year when the phone starts to ring with people calling in about their allergic dogs.
Richard in Two Rivers has something that may relate to this. Richard, hi.
Yeah, hey, Larry, how you been?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Okay, I got the greatest dog in the world, you know, but everybody will say that, but it is.
W-I-C.
And she's 7 years old. She's a golden doodle. Never been sick, always been to the vet, and the vet said she's the healthiest dog you ever seen. She chases the ball for hours a day, swims every day in Lake Michigan.
Sure.
And she started itching about 6 months ago. And she started itching behind her ears, and she caused scabs in her ears. And they ended up, I treated them with a little bit of hydrogen peroxide in case there was an ear infection. And then I put, Vaseline in there. And it definitely helped. She stopped, but she still scratches every time. She doesn't scratch all the time, but whenever we leave the house, she gets out on the lawn, she scratches for like 20 minutes.
Oh, boy. Well, there are times when ears are ears, and what takes place inside the ears are just exactly that. And people ask me, where does my dog get an ear infection? And my answer is from the ears, because I cannot imagine a better place to grow things, because ears are warm and they're moist and there's a dead end and there's sloughing cells and blood and wax. It's just a great place to grow things. So sometimes ears are ears. And sometimes ears are an extension of the skin, and what's going on with the skin will also affect the ears. So first of all, I love the notion that you've got the greatest dog ever, and I hope that everybody thinks that way. And you may take a look at, are there other areas aside from just the ears that are affected? And man, it's not my nature to fly in the face of things that are working. And when you say you use peroxide and Vaseline, if there are a couple of things I would not recommend, it would be peroxide and Vaseline.
Oh, and I'll tell you what, we'll give you a chance, Dr. Bill, to explain why after we take this quick look at the news. We'll be back with Dr. Bill Stork right after the news. Taking a look at your pet's health on the program today with our guest, Dr. Bill Stork. He's the owner and operator of Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic. He's authored several books. It's always great to have him come by. Question about your pet's health. I hope you join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Bill, just as we were breaking for news, we had a caller online with a golden doodle with itchy ears. Ears are a great place to grow things, as you mentioned. And the caller had mentioned that he had used hydrogen peroxide and something else. And you were saying that that's not a good idea, the hydrogen peroxide.
I'd be cautious of that. And he also said that it seemed to make them better. But things to keep in mind with regard to peroxide is that it is pretty harsh. And if there is any open skin or any lesions down inside of those ears, it can be really, really irritating. And the thing about Vaseline, That's a petroleum-based product, and we try and avoid viscous things in ears because if there's any infection, it can kind of seal things off. So we have better options.
And the best options?
Well, it depends on the situation. Without actually seeing those ears and seeing those dogs, it would be a little bit tough for me to comment on that.
Deb in La Crosse emailed and wonders if you know why there's so many allergic dogs in the past few years versus 20 years ago when it was nearly unheard of. And she mentions as well, she never misses these pet shows.
I don't know if there's more or whether we're more aware of it. I certainly don't think it is about the food, because that's a really easy place to place the blame. It could be more intense breeding than what it used to be. Although, honestly, I see as many golden retrievers and labs as I do mutts that arrive on a transport from Houston, Texas, or Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama. It really does seem to be a pretty even distribution of the allergic dogs that we see.
Julie from Eau Claire emailed in. She's inherited both of her kids' cats. I can speak to that. I've had some experience in that area. One cat's bigger, not declawed, and was a barn cat before we got him. That's Kevin. We got Stormy, a small female, declawed. The former owner did that. And they've been together for over 3 years. Seems Kevin would like to befriend Stormy, but she wants nothing to do with him. Any ideas? 3 years.
Well,
that's a long time.
And therein lies the dilemma of cats. And you're not going to have a lot of success trying to lubricate those relationships. The best thing that you can do is try and set the stage for success in making sure you have multiple copies of any limiting resource, namely litter boxes. Litter boxes on every floor of the house that the cats occupy. Scratching posts, spaces, hides, cat trees, things like that, also distributed throughout the house. But then, if there is anything that could potentially work, and I'm making the assumption that these guys don't attack one another, you're just looking for them to commingle more. A tool that has been proven to work are these feel away or pheromone products. And initially, to an old guy in practice for a long time, pheromone products sounded like a little bit of hocus pocus medicine to me. But we have seen situations where feel away is the product that we know by brand. These pheromone products have made a difference in blinded studies. And when I say blinded studies, I mean, we have an owner who had three cats. They were not getting along well. And among other things, we prescribed Feel-Away. Took the diffuser, plugged it into the wall. We followed up a couple of weeks later, and we're not going to say things were warm and fuzzy, but there was a lot less bloodshed than there had been. They were getting along noticeably better. Several months later, the telephone call comes to say that it was no longer working. We were pretty frustrated until we figured out that the owner's son had unplugged the Feel-Away to recharge his iPad. And once we plugged the Feel-Away in, it was back to peace, love, and harmony. We've also seen situations with regard to Feel-Away use where, and here's the ultimate blinded study in my mind, the husband notices. And when husbands notice, it's obvious the cats are getting along better. So Feel-Away is the answer.
Benita in Houston, Minnesota has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Benita.
Hi there. I've got a four-year-old dog, Ember. I got her as a young pup. She was an accidental pregnancy in my coworker's dog. So she's half Springer Spaniel, half Lab. Very high-energy dog. She traveled very well in my vehicle. But then I got a high-top van that I now live in, and she is crazy anxious with traveling. So I've tried crating her. I've tried the Thunder Vest, tried pheromones. I've tried CBD oil. I've talked to the vet, and we tried her on gabapentine, but that gave her urinary incontinence, so we quit that. So I did consider an animal behaviorist, but it's a little bit out of my budget. Any ideas?
Well, as your veterinarian and you have discovered, we're probably not going to entirely be able to medicate our way out of this situation. And I'm hoping that you still have terrestrial accommodations. I'm hoping you still have the house, because if you were to hire a behaviorist, the things that they would recommend, and you, by the way, you've done an amazing job so far, would be to dive into this counter conditioning thing. And we've talked about counter conditioning for lots of different applications, but essentially what it boils down to is ensuring the dog does not get out of their comfort zone. So if this van is sitting there, then you walk the dog around the van. You walk the dog up to the van to the point where he or she is about to get anxious. And then you reward the dog, walk away. You may do that for 2 weeks. Now, this is going to be a little bit tough if you're planning to head to Florida, you know, at Thanksgiving, because these processes take an incredibly long period of time. And you get the notion. You get to the point where you can get in the van, reward, leave to the end of the driveway around the block. And then you get to the point where you take really short excursions to some place that the dog dearly loves so that they can start to associate that high top van with going to, you know, going to Culver's to get a pup cup or going to the dog park or going to their favorite friends. And then of course, and I bet you're doing these things already. I mean, you just described a rocket ship and all of the other things that you can do to backload your situation to set you up for success. You know, to walk that dog as far as you can possibly walk for a long sniffing walk in a novel environment so that they can wear out their brains and wear out physically before you get them started in the van.
Benita, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Mary in Columbus, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. Question about my dog, who was diagnosed with pancreatitis. She was before she was diagnosed, not wanting to eat. She would go like a couple days and then finally, you know, eat something, probably because she was so darn hungry. And then vomited a couple of times. So I finally took her in, and that's what they diagnosed her with. And she is now currently on a diet, a prescription diet, which is costly. But I'm just curious, will this be a lifelong condition for her, or is it something that you treat and once you get it under control? So just wondering a little bit about what's going on here.
A couple of questions, Mary. What breed is your dog, and were you able to identify any dietary infractions before this started, like a big bunch of pork chop scraps?
Yeah, here's the background. She was my brother's dog, and he passed away a couple of years ago, and I inherited her. I know she was often, we just, you know, checked it off as being finicky. Oh, I thought, well, maybe she's tired of this food and would try a different food. And and she's a lab, she's a mix. She's a lab and a golden retriever, we believe. So, and I will say that once she's on this diet, and she's been on it now for several months, you know, she's excited to eat again. She comes and tells me basically, hey, I'm hungry, let's get the food out. So that's really enjoyable to see that she actually, you know, wants to eat again. So they've got her on this low-fat diet. So prior to that, I was feeding her Purina Pro Plan. She would get a greenie every day for her teeth. And not a whole lot of extra treats. I will say, though, she would get some table scraps and whatever protein we might have had.
At that, I will interject, and I think I can answer your question succinctly by saying, be really, really cautious of extraneous fat sources. If table scraps, you know, if that's wrong, I don't want to be right, but make sure that if there's pieces of steak, hamburger, or pork chop in there, limit the fat, and you should cruise along and be okay.
Yeah, stay away from that. Mary, thank you for calling. Mona in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Mona.
Hi, I have three cats, and one is a Burman, and they're kind of a needy breed. I know the last one I had was that way, too. But my two males, there's some tension between them, even though they kind of grew up together. They were both pretty young. I got one a year later, got them both as kittens, and they were all fixed and everything. The female's just shy and hides a lot. So anyway, what's happening is my Burman gets jealous of my Persian male. And if he's up on the couch and if he's trying to kind of groom the Persian kind of pushes him away, he'll turn around and pee on my couch. And I have had him checked for UTI. That was first go-to. And I used the feel-aways. I had to go to an extra strength one. He also has attacked about maybe three times over 7-8 years. There that I found an injury that I'm pretty sure was from him on my Persian. But I don't see fights really break out a lot. It's not like a big game changer, but between the peeing that and his being vocal all night long, I've got him also on amitriptyline. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly.
You bet.
I had to go, it was a quarter, I can't remember the strength, but it was a quarter pill. I had to go up to a half a pill because a quarter pill was no longer working. I'm just kind of wondering, is that going to still, I had to go to extra strength feel away plugins. Now I have to go to a little more medication. He's 8 years old, he's 7 or 8. Just not sure, is amitriptyline safe to be on long term? Is he going to have to be on something else? What would you recommend?
Well, Mona, first of all, you're swimming upstream. You've got one heck of a challenge there. And you've done a whole lot of really most excellent things and have gotten some really good care, some really good advice. And take the discussions that we've had earlier in the show with regard to engaging. Well, I guess we talked about engaging dogs, but if that cat will be engaged, as in play, as in exercise, that is a thing that can be beneficial. I would have reached for fluoxetine first as compared to amitriptyline, but they're both most excellent choices. The other thing that you can do in a situation like this is when the cat is, you say jealousy, we say resource guarding. If he's doing that, pick him up and take him someplace else. But there's not going to be a stone cold fix for this condition. And I mean, you've got your work cut out for you.
Yeah. Yes, you do, Mona. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Any tips for cutting the nails on a dog who absolutely hates getting their paws touched?
Do not make it a wrestling match. And, you know, what we've heard over the years is that, oh my gosh, it takes my son, it takes my son and his buddies, it takes the offensive line of the Packers to hold this dog down to trim his nails. The short answer is touch training. And what touch training is an adaptation of counter conditioning and dramatically compressed. There are wonderful videos online that what you can do is slowly over time condition them to allow their nails to be trimmed. And I won't break down the whole process. I see we've only got a few minutes left in the show. Other things that can be beneficial are, and I thought it was crazy talk when I first heard about it, but my daughter is actually using it on her Vizsla named Ruby. Is she uses the scratch pads, and the scratch pads can be very, very beneficial. And what we'll do here at the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, because we have on staff behaviorists, is sometimes we will sedate them, trim their nails all the way back to as short as they can possibly be trimmed. So that buys us some weeks or some months to work on the behavioral thing. And when we say sedation, we're talking about stone cold asleep, because if you try and give them just a little something to take the edge off, the minute you get within 3 feet of a nail trimmer, they will burn right through that something to take the edge off.
There you go. We have a question from Claire in Madison. Partner wants to adopt a German Shepherd. She knows these are working dogs. What should she know before adopting a working dog like a Shepherd? They have a decent-sized yard for being in town, but Claire is pretty active as well. And
well, that's a great set of considerations, because that could be an absolutely positively wonderful dog. And that fenced-in backyard is ideal when it's 16 below zero and blowing snow and 4:30 in the morning when the dog's got to go outside and go to the bathroom. But just as we wouldn't have anybody pick up a copy of the paper and read that same newspaper for months on end, getting that dog socialized, you know, Madison, that is great. Because you've got every conceivable direction that you can go to introduce sounds and smells and feels and experiences. And depending on the age of the dog, I would encourage your partner to be discerning, because if you go to pick up that dog and that dog comes and runs over, sits at your feet, accepts treats, that's fantastic. From our side of the table, we see situations whereby people will go to adopt a dog that's got some age on it. Could be 9 months, could be a year and a half. And that dog shudders and hides under the bench and hides under the table. And with the best of intentions, people will say, well, I'm going to take that dog home. I'm going to socialize it and I'm going to love it out of this dog. Well, you very well may, but not every dog will be able to become socialized when they start off shy, when they weren't socialized on the front end. when they were trained based with forceful tactics, with punishment, and God forbid, you know, shock collars and pinch collars and things like that. So, you know, if the dog is friendly and social and a little bit shy, fantastic. If the dog is really timid, be very careful.
Yeah, there you go. Halloween coming up, and we see trick-or-treaters can make pets nervous, maybe cause them to try to escape through an open door, for sure. So that we need to be careful about that. And I see some pets dressed up for Halloween. Is that problematic?
Well, not if the dog is good with it. You know, all of the things that we talk about in each of these episodes with regard to socialization and exposure, and man, it's a thing. I think people spend more money on costumes for their dogs than they do for people. And so long as your dog is great with little kids, reaching out to them when they're on walks, and so long as they're trustworthy, and so long as they're not going to stick their head in the treat bucket and eat a bunch of Snickers bars, then it's fantastic.
Yeah, my cat Tiger, I think Halloween is the favorite time of the year, because all of the people coming, I keep the main door open, and the storm door is all glass, so Tiger can look out and see everybody, and the kids can see him, and it's a very, very good thing. One more quick question. Cats and greenies, and this is, I have had this problem. The cats don't want to eat anything but the greenies, or maybe just a little bit of the other food. Is that a problem?
Well, a diet of greenies is not a balanced diet, but there's another great tool out there. And our clinic sells Royal Canin. I'm sure that Hills makes a version of a dental diet. And it is expensive, but then again, so is a surgical dental at your veterinary clinic. So that dental diet can be part of their normal food, and you can just mix it in.
Bill, thank you so much for being with us again. I know you're going to be back, I think, on January 28th. In the meantime, it's been always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and we'll look forward to your next visit.
You bet. Thanks, Larry. Appreciate it.
Dr. Bill Stork of the Lake Mills Veterinary Clinic, our guest, and he will be back January 28th, and we'll talk with him again. Coming up, we're going to take a look at reptiles as pets. I'm Larry Mueller. He's a lucky snake from Disney Music to get us going on this section of the program. Thank you so much for being with us today as we take a look at reptiles as pets. And we missed by a day. Yesterday was National Reptile Awareness Day. So we're a day late, but we're not a dollar short, because we have a great guest for you today to talk about reptiles as pets. Over 6 million households in the U.S. have reptiles as pets, according to the American Pet Products Association. And we're going to talk about how to keep a pet reptile and why we should appreciate them with our guest, Bill Stewart. He is the owner of WPS Reptiles. It's a business that entertains and educates children and adults about reptiles. And if you own a reptile or a pet, maybe you could tell us about the joys and challenges of that, or maybe how you overcame a fear of reptiles. Hope to hear from you. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Bill Stewart, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be a part of this today. This is awesome.
Tell us about WPS Reptiles. What's the mission of the organization? Where and how did you get it started?
I started WPS Reptiles in 2020, and my point is just to kind of not only educate people about reptiles, but entertain them as well. I think there could be something really powerful in interacting with reptiles hands-on. So I do a lot of presentations that are geared towards kids and families, teaching kids about reptiles, what makes them excellent pets, why they're important in their ecosystems in the wild, and just supporting people who do keep them as pets. And so my whole point is just to educate and entertain. I bring reptiles to birthday parties and school assemblies, and I've done corporate presentations and all sorts of stuff. So it's been fun, but I've been a reptile educator for 20 years doing it with different other groups, and just starting my own business in 2020 was really gratifying.
It must be. How did your love of reptiles begin?
Since I was a child, I was a little 3 or 4 year old boy fascinated by dinosaurs. And I think I was about 5 years old when my dad found a garter snake in the yard, and I was just instantly hooked. Snakes are fascinating animals, and little 5 year old Billy was very excited. And I've just loved reptiles ever since then. I have been keeping them as pets since I was 9. I think I was 9 years old when I got my first lizards. It helped a little bit that my mom and dad were allergic to cats and dogs. My mom was allergic to cats and dogs, and so we couldn't have conventional pets. And I think I might have tugged on those guilt strings a little bit and getting lizards and snakes. I was 16 years old with 15 tanks in my bedroom with various snakes and lizards and stuff like that, much to my parents' chagrin, but they were supportive of me still. I've just been fascinated by these animals my whole life.
What are some common misconceptions about them?
There are a lot, and a lot of the education that I do is trying to help people kind of realize like eliminate the misconceptions and the myths. A huge one is especially associated with snakes, that snakes are trying to chase you, snakes can eat you, snakes want to hurt you, and that is far from the truth. Usually snakes, even when they're most dangerous and in their most defensive behaviors, just want to be left alone. They don't want to become prey to something else. They don't want to get hurt. They want to protect themselves. And so they'll behave in a way to just kind of be left alone. But we as humans think that they're out to kill us, that they're going to chase us and want to eat us when we're not looking. And that's a huge one.
Yeah. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Vern.
Hi. Yeah, in 1950 in town of Wilson out here, we got a little creek. It's got a little bridge across it. And from down south, the entire little creek was filled with snakes, water moccasins, and I don't know if they're rattlesnakes, but they could swim in water 3 and 4 feet long. Then they had a sea turtle like 2.5 feet long that was black, and these guys were shooting with their shotguns and .22s. They must have killed 50 or 100 snakes.
Well, that's a sad story, Bill.
Yeah, I understand that people are afraid of snakes, and I respect that, and I respect that. There is a danger when interacting with venomous snakes. Water moccasins and copperheads can be venomous. A lot of times you're putting yourself in danger by messing with them, and the best thing to do is leave them alone. Obviously, if you're in a situation where the snakes are not wanted, if you find a venomous snake in your backyard or in your neighborhood, there are people to call that can safely remove it and relocate it. I definitely would love if people stopped killing snakes, but that's quite an uphill battle that I'm fighting. But interacting with venomous snakes, you're putting yourself in danger when it's just easy to leave them alone. In the springtime, snakes are coming out of brumation and they're breeding, so you're going to see a lot more of them. They're going to be a lot more active in the spring months when it's starting to warm up. And again, I mean, if you could just leave them alone, that'd be great. If they're in a creek bed on your property or you're worried about your kids getting hurt, the best thing to do is to call the DNR or call a local business that can just remove and relocate them safely.
I was thinking as you were talking about, you mentioned rattlesnakes, I think. I had a guy on the show a few years back who was talking about a person who was studying rattlesnakes and was studying a mother with her babies, and the kind of care that she gave as a mother. And I think we don't view snakes in that kind of capacity.
No, we don't view that. And I think those of us that keep reptiles as pets and those of us in the community that study reptiles more are learning more about reptiles and reptile intelligence, that they're not just, you know, fight or flight brainstem machines, but there is some intelligence to them. And there are some reptiles. I'm not as familiar with snakes, but I am definitely familiar with lizards, and particularly skinks are lizards where the mother and father skink are going to live in a family unit. They're going to raise the babies together, and they're living more in these like family cliques. And there are some species of reptiles that do have like maternal instincts. They're not just going to lay their eggs and ditch. They're going to lay their eggs, protect the eggs, and protect the young. The most well-known of that are crocodilians, alligators. Anyone who's come across an alligator nest knows that the mom is going to protect her eggs and protect her young. So there can be evidence of like maternal instinct in reptiles. That is interesting about snakes. I'm not as familiar with that maternal instinct with like snakes and venomous snakes, but I'm sure the evidence is there. Rattlesnakes have live birth. So where most snake species are going to lay eggs and young are going to hatch out of eggs, rattlesnakes carry their young and have a live baby that's born. There are other species of snake that do the same thing, and that could be evidence more too of more of a maternal instinct that's found. But that is interesting that there's the research on rattlesnakes being more maternal.
How can or how does WPS, your company, WPS, sort of refute these misconceptions that exist about reptiles?
I think the best way to do it is just by interacting with the public. If I'm at a birthday party or I'm at a community event and I'm there with my animals and kids and families are able to come up and handle the animals, all the animals that I bring, I usually bring lizards, I usually bring snakes, I bring tortoises, I have some frogs. All the animals are safe for interaction, so the kids aren't going to get bit. The animals are used to being handled, and I think that interaction in and of itself can help people kind of recognize that snakes aren't dangerous, that reptiles aren't trying to hurt you. But just having that hands-on interaction and those conversations with people, you know, I've had a lot of people approach me at my events that are, you know, scared of snakes or nervous, but they don't want to be afraid. They want to ask those questions, and having a little bit of empathy with people too. Like, people aren't, you know, malicious and on purpose in their negative thoughts. It's sometimes just that people don't know better, or people grew up in environments where, you know, mom and dad were afraid of snakes, grandma was afraid of snakes, so now I'm afraid of snakes because I've inherited that fear. And having empathy with people and their experiences can help to kind of combat some of the myths and misconceptions about reptiles. But it's just that grassroots, you know, conversation at a park or conversation at a pet shop, where I think that could be really powerful for people.
Yeah. Do you do a lot of presentations like that through WRS Reptiles?
I do. So with WPS, I do like smaller birthday parties. I'll do larger school assemblies. I love supporting the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, so I'll do events for them. I also am on the board of directors for Badgerland Reptile Rescue, which is a reptile rescue in Kenosha, Wisconsin. We act as a humane society almost for reptile species. We'll take in animals that are unwanted. We'll make sure they're healthy, and we'll find homes for them. And then I'm on the board for it's currently called the Wisconsin Herp Association, but it used to be called the Madison Area Herp Society. And we've done a lot of education and presentations and resource fairs in the community. So in those three areas, I've done a lot of reptile education.
My daughter's a senior in college and in marine biology, but she's a big herp lover and worked at the Milwaukee Zoo last summer on an internship. And I got a lot of joy out of giving presentations to kids when she'd have a snake or another reptile to talk about. And she always said the kids lit up and were always excited to be able to touch or handle the animals that she presented.
They're fascinating animals, and they really are, and they're truly unique. And, you know, you could read books about reptiles and you could see them on movies and TV, but to interact with one and handle one, it's truly a unique experience, I think. Of course, I'm biased. I've grown up with these animals, but I think that there is something really powerful in that. And I, you know, my full-time job, I work with kids in the community. I'm a therapist, and working with kids with attention issues or anxieties or whatever, sometimes having a reptile present can help grab a kid's attention. It can sustain a kid's attention. And there's such a powerful interaction in those moments.
Bill Stewart, our guest today, he is the owner of WPS Reptiles. Great to have him with us as we talk about reptiles as pets. And maybe you have a reptile as a pet. I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts about them. Or maybe you have a question or maybe interested in obtaining one. Number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today as we take a look at reptiles as pets with our guest today, Bill Stewart. He owns WPS Reptiles. And if you type WPS Reptiles into your Google, you will get to their site, which is, he's got some great pictures, great photos, and a lot of really good information about reptiles and about his business, WPS. Kathy in Bayfield has something for us. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. I've always been really enthralled with snakes. And back there many years ago, I lived on a small farm in Door County. There was a hay field that hadn't been mowed the previous year, and I was out running with my dog and walking through the property, and this entire hay field in the spring was just covered with little coiled patches of snakes, all different sizes, sunning themselves. There must have been at least 100, and it's just been one of those remarkable, kind of wondrous moments that I've kept in my memory over the years.
Oh, that's great, Kathy. Comment, Bill?
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. I wish I could have seen that field myself. It would have been really cool. And I appreciate that you thought it was a really beautiful sight as well. One of the most common snakes we have in Wisconsin is the garter snake. They're black with kind of greenish yellowy stripes. There's different species of them in Wisconsin. And they will kind of, the reptile version of hibernate is brumate. And so in the winter months, they're gonna hunker down in underground in, you know, caves and whatever. And brumate, and they all do it together. So the word is a hibernaculum. They're all going to be in there. There's hundreds of them in these little hibernating areas together. And then when the weather warms up, they're all going to come out. They're going to warm up, and then they're going to mate. And you can find these garter snakes, hundreds and hundreds of them, all over the fields. In Door County especially, that's a really good place to see them. That's a really cool story. I haven't seen anything like that. So I'm going to have to go spend some spring months out in Door County.
Kathy, thanks again. Appreciate it very much. That's a wonderful story. And doesn't sound like you were nervous or scared. That's a good thing, too. Ruth and Eau Claire, will go to you. Hi, Ruth.
Yeah. I was replanting some things last week. As I was shoveling down and throwing the dirt, out pops a frog, and it clearly had been in hibernation. It just didn't hardly move at all, and I was wondering, you know, a lot of people are planting trees and putting other things in the fall. What do you do? I mean, I left it sitting out. I kind of covered it up a little bit, but I didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
The next morning it's to be gone, but.
Yeah, Ruth, thank you for calling. What about that, Bill?
That's a really good question. Honestly, these animals are very adaptive to the environments. Their generations and generations grew up in Wisconsin, and they know how to survive on their own. If you see a frog in your yard, if you're digging up a tree and you dig one up by accident, moving him aside, he'll find another place to go. Leaving them outside is fine. I know people get nervous about the winter months, but these animals have lived in Wisconsin before we did, and they know how to survive and they know how to adapt in these climates and the weather changes. So if you accidentally dig up a frog or dig up a toad, set them off to the side, out of harm's way is probably the best thing to do. You know, the same recommendation, if you find a snake in your yard that you don't want, moving them as close as you can to where you are, but out of harm's way is fine. Turtles crossing the road, just move them off to the side of the road. They know how to find their way around. They know how to survive, and they know how to change. They know how to adapt in the changing environments outside. So the best thing to do is let them mind your business. They're a good thing to see in your yard. Frogs and toads and snakes are going to eat the things that you don't want in your yard. They're going to scare away the things that you don't want messing with your gardens. And so they're kind of a little lucky charm if you find them in your backyard or your garden.
Marie in Wausau will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Marie.
Well, and I actually wanted to thank you for this topic and for educating people. We kind of fell into being, we own a Western hognose pet because there's so many allergens in my house, no cats, no dogs, no birds. And what I found out after we got the snake is that my family feels about snakes the way I feel about rodents. So do you have any advice, first of all, for talking to people who you're trying to overcome a lot of fear of snakes, but also when people talk to you about getting a snake as a pet, do you have any resources you direct them to?
That is an awesome question. I'm going to try and remember there's kind of a multiple things that we could touch on in there. There are still a lot of people that are afraid of snakes. There are still a lot of people that don't understand how important snakes are in their ecosystem, the niche that they have in their environments. There are a lot of people who are just wish snakes were dead. And it's hard to combat that. I think what I try to do my best is figure out where that is coming from in some people. Some people have a hatred or a fear of snakes because they had an adverse experience as a kid. Maybe they got bit, maybe they fell on a nature hike and bumped into a snake. I know people who are afraid of snakes that have never even interacted with one in real life. And sometimes that interaction, so your family who don't like snakes and they think they're gross, without being pushy, maybe they would be willing to like see you holding the snake or learn more about it. Because I think a lot of that fear just comes from not knowing. And a lot of that fear comes from just, you know, again, those myths that snakes are going to kill me, they can eat me. As far as keeping snakes as pets, that was one of my things I wanted to touch on is just there's a community out there. Hognose are very beautiful snakes, and they're awesome pets to have. They have the cute little faces. For those of you who are listening who are not familiar with hognose snakes, they're called hognose snakes because they have a rostral scale. So the tip of their nose has a little pointy scale that digs up, and it kind of makes them look like a little pig nose. They use it for digging and burrowing purposes out in the wild, but they just have a really cute little face that's become really attractive to people, and they've become really popular pet snakes recently. There are in the state of Wisconsin, we have a multitude of reptile expos where you could go and purchase a pet snake. You can talk to people who live in your community who work with them as pets, who breed them. And so my advice would be to do research in wherever you live on what reptile expos are in your area, that you could go and buy pet snakes, but you could also talk to breeders and learn from them. Social media is a pretty powerful tool for that. So you could find Facebook groups that are specific to hognose keepers where you can ask questions about their care. And you could just share your love and find other people out there who love hognose as much as you do.
Yeah.
That would be my recommendations.
And in terms of any written materials or anything, you have some things on your site, I believe.
I might on my site, but if I don't, there are some really great resources. I could share them with you guys after the Zoom call of some really good websites that can provide more information on keeping snakes as pets, keeping hognose as pets.
That sounds good. Thank you. And Marie, thank you for calling. Ruth in Chippewa Falls, your turn.
Yes, I used to live in Florida, and I went walking on a boardwalk in a park, and there was a man pointing out a snake ball, and he said it was a bunch of snakes that were mating. Do they do that here?
The garter snakes will do that here. I've never seen it, but when garter snakes breed, female garter snakes are twice as big as the males. And so when they're coming out of hibernation and they're warming up in the spring, they do breed in these weird balls. There are other species of snakes that do it too. Anacondas down in South America will do it, where anaconda females are twice as big as the males. And there's a poor anaconda female slithering just trying to mind her own business. And there's 30 snakes like all coiled up on top of her, all balling around trying to be the one male to break through and complete the deed, so to speak. Sorry if this is I'm trying to be as appropriate as possible on the radio. We do have garter snakes in Wisconsin that will do that, and it is a very bizarre sight to see if you've never seen it before.
Ruth, thank you. Bruce in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I just want to mention two things. One is that there is an illicit trade in some endangered reptiles, and people need to be careful about that. Reptiles can be brought in from overseas illegally, and that results in a very high mortality rate when it's done that way. Also, I think some reptiles, particularly iguanas, tend to have a really high rate of salmonella infestation. I might be wrong on that, but I remember reading that.
There are some species of reptiles that are a little bit more notorious for having salmonella, and a lot of it comes from, obviously, reptiles hatch from eggs, and when they are young and they are kind of fresh from the egg, there could be some remaining egg material that's on the animals. Younger kids are going to get salmonella if they play with a reptile and they don't wash their hands and then put their fingers in their mouths. The best way to combat salmonella is by simply washing your hands with soap and warm water after you interact with a reptile and making sure that surfaces are clean. So if you have a pet lizard and he's sitting on your kitchen counter and then you put him away, make sure you sanitize the kitchen counter afterwards. But just that hygiene after interacting with a reptile is the best way to combat salmonella. But there are instances of people getting sick from reptiles still, making sure that if you keep a reptile as a pet, you're keeping their cage clean, their water is clean, you're cleaning up after them when they make a mess, and you're keeping yourself clean after you interact, and that's the best way to do it. Really quick, too, I'll be 20 seconds. There are still instances of animals being smuggled into the country illegally. There still is a sect of reptile keeping where they're wild catching animals and keeping them as pets. That's a whole rabbit hole that we could go down on a different day. But there are in the state of Wisconsin a tremendous amount of people who are keeping these animals legally, obtaining them legally, not you know, illegal, not smuggled. A lot of the DNR in the state is very active in making sure that people are keeping the animals legally. And there are people, like I said, that are breeding these animals ethically. And having a population of animals that are bred and in captivity will help eliminate the need for them to come out of the wild. And that's something that we as reptile keepers really advocate for, is, you know, buying an animal that is captive bred, that someone hatched in captivity in the state of Wisconsin or, you know, in one of the 50 states. The animal's going to be healthier. It's going to be more rewarding pet. It's not going to succumb to illness quite as a wild-caught animal would.
Well, on that note, here we are about out of time, Bill. I want to thank you so much. I hope there's a lot more we could talk about that we haven't had the time to cover. And so I hope you'll come back and be with us again, and we can talk again about reptiles.
I would love to come back anytime. This was awesome. I would love to, you know, come out and be in person at the studio next time, too. That would be fantastic. Bill, I'll bring some critters with me next time.
Okay. Bill, thank you so much. Take a look at his website. Just type in WPS Reptiles. Bill, of course, the business located out of Kenosha, Wisconsin. It's great to have him with us, and we will get him back, and we will do this again for sure. It's fun talking with him. And we got a fun group, as a matter of fact. We got some great producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. We got great technical directors, Lee Rayburn on with me today, but Jeff Robbins as well. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller, of course, and I hope you'll stay tuned because there's lots more in store right through the day here on WPR News. He's a lucky